Okay, this is our next installment of Carol and I reviewing Marsha McLuhan's Mosaic, subtitled Probing the Literary Origins of Media Studies by the Italian professor Elena Lamberti. And we're now starting Chapter 5, which is titled A Conscious Modernist Craftsman. And then the first subsection is called A Pioneer of Modernist Studies, but it has in brackets the word new, so it means a pioneer of new modernist studies. So what did you find in this chapter, Carolyn?
Well, what's interesting, when I'm staring at the title and subtitle, Probing the Literary Origins of Media Studies, so she's saying McLuhan is a student of the media, he's a media studies critic, but it's going to be about literacy, Bob, and everyone's, well, most of the time, most of our sessions, we end up sort of smacking our heads saying, well, she's not even getting to tactility. She's not understanding the other bits. But she states she's just doing a literary probe. What do you say to that?
I wouldn't disagree. Yeah, she's showing the literary roots of media studies. She thinks that in college today, media studies are focused on non-literary aspects of media. Mm-hmm. They don't acknowledge the McLuhan's roots in literary studies, unless an obscure student here and there looks into it, studies Don Thiel, finds out about the literary background. They wouldn't know that. So she feels that this is a missing aspect of the Media Ecology Association. That's why she wrote the book. She didn't think that her fellow media ecologists, professors, most of them, were acknowledging the literary parts of media studies, the literary origins, at least from a major figure in media ecology, Marsha McLuhan.
Right, and it is important to always look at the where you came from, where you're going, even though there's no time in it, it's all here at once. But
read the first sentence.
The first sentence is, in the 1980s, as an undergraduate at the University of Bologna, specializing in modernist studies, I had no idea of the existence of a volume called The Interior Landscape, The Literary Criticism of Marsha McLuhan.
Yeah, see, there's the point.
Right.
She wants future students not to have that gap in their
right.
knowledge of media studies, not to know about McLuhan's literary criticism is pretty vacant, and I don't know if she knew much about McLuhan that early anyways.
Right, she said, McLuhan was renowned worldwide as the media guru or the media oracle, but certainly not as a professor of English literature. In addition, in the 1980s, his star was no longer shining as it had during the previous two decades. Yeah, things just go too fast. She's just giving an example of how sped up things are, even in university when they're supposed to make connections. They're supposed to tell you the origins of things.
Yeah, it's this Andy Warhol syndrome. In 15 minutes, everybody will be famous.
Yeah.
No, that's not what he was known for. That was his later version. He originally said everybody was famous for 15 minutes, so McLuhan got his 15 minutes, and then things circulated with other people becoming famous,
right,
replacing him. Now, doesn't she say she doesn't really know about McLuhan until 1996?
Here, yeah. Let's continue on a couple sentences later. When I finally managed to read McLuhan's literary criticism, I had already entered a PhD program, and I was almost 10 years older, by the mid-1990s, modernist studies were something different from what I had been taught originally, New scholars had opened the field up to new interdisciplinary perspectives and had, so to speak, broken the vessels of previous interpretations. So, yeah, not until the mid-90s. So here she's, what's the date of this book?
2012.
So mid-90s, so it's 20 years later, she's writing a very comprehensive book of his. So
yeah.
she really got captivated by McLuhan.
Yeah, I remember her at the 1998 Legacy of McLuhan Symposium, March 1998, that the Media College Association came out of, and she was a speaker there. I know she did something maybe about Thomas Aquinas, but she was just a neophyte, you know, just a new person. So I think in my mind she got into McLuhan seriously about 1996.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And pretty quickly she writes a book around 2000 on McLuhan.
Oh, okay.
But she doesn't seem to have a deep understanding of McLuhan by 2004 because she's thrown by that student who asked her why should he read all of it? Just tell him what pages to read of some book.
For the test. For the exam.
Yeah, and as a teacher, that threw her. So she had not been applying to McLuhan to the changes in her students.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jim Turner, a lawyer in Washington who's studying McLuhan in depth with me, he is reading this book, and he mm-hmm. says that he makes an interesting point that Elena made the wrong turn. She shouldn't have got so upset by the kid, you know, having this odd, lazy kind of view. Jim thought that she should have taken a different tact, applying more McLuhan to the problems, to the student situation. Can't remember right now what Jim suggested, but it was valid. She could have reinterpreted she should not have objected to it.
So in her objection, it threw her back into looking at the literary origins instead of interpreting him as a digital kid, and he was just into his chip body.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what Jim said, but
that's what we would say.
You would say. But the thing is that she had an identity crisis about her own profession, so she went back to see where her profession fits into media studies,
right.
And she found out McLuhan got it all from literacy, and that was great, or from literature.
Yeah.
So she spent the next, 6-7 years writing out her dilemma.
Yes.
And then she published in 2012. And the Media College Association gave her an award in 2016. So they thought that the book was relevant to their world.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
They needed the correction, maybe.
Right. So a few sentences along, I've got, to have read The Interior Landscape at an earlier stage in my educational career would have helped me better understand literature, not only as a subject but also as a function, because in that book, McLuhan turns the modernist literary masterpieces into cognitive tools to better understand new environmental processes. So, yeah, she's regretting that she didn't read this earlier, and just like we're saying, it helps her ground herself even more so in her literacy.
Yeah. But her statement there is correct. Mm-hmm. You apply media studies as a cognitive tool to literature and how the literature is relevant to today, if it is or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, Finnegan's Wake was the most relevant modernist artifact that applied to it today, and then she found that out.
Yeah, two sentences below, the investigation of language and the playful creation of neologisms capable of translating the societal dynamic processes are what McLuhan mostly admired in Joyce and in the other modernists. So, okay, so then what I jump to the next paragraph. Are you ready to move on?
Yeah, I'll just say the other Joyce and the other modernists, that is one level of the four evangelists, which are a theme all the way through the book, mm-hmm. through Finnegan's Wake. That would be Pound, Eliot, Lewis, and Yeats. So the four vortices that Joyce was talking with, interacting with, and learning about media studies from them.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's the other modernists besides Joyce.
Okay. So next paragraph. By casting modernism in the light of broader cultural and theoretical approaches, McLuhan anticipated future trends of modernist studies. In the early 1990s, Marjorie Perloff commented on the
dichotomic. Means dichotomy, split.
Yeah. I've never dichotomic lines of research dominating that area of studies at a time when McLuhan was already developing a different strategy of observation. So that's just her, again, going back to he's a modernist now, but he got it from his literary background. So I don't...
From his modernist background, many people think McLuhan is the first early postmodernist writer. So this is saying Marjorie Perloff commented on the different splitting that was going on in modernist studies when McLuhan was already doing... So others were starting to split off with a new way to look at modernism in the 1970s, and nobody knew that McLuhan had already done what they were doing in the 70s. He had done in the 50s.
And why didn't they know he was doing it? He just wasn't recognized?
It wasn't recognized, no.
Okay.
I mean, McLuhan was suppressed in many ways, and was on his colleague Northrop Frye.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and she goes into this whole modernist business, because we come across that with Lewis as well. They called him a modernist. So this is... Now, who... What's your reference for this this quote? I'll speak the quote. Surely no literary term has raised more controversy and misunderstanding than the modest little word modernism. Once the site of all that was radical, exciting, and above all new, by the early 1970s, modernism found itself under attack as a retrograde elitist movement. At best, the final phase of the Great Romantic Revolution. At worst, the aestheticist's reaction formation to an alienated social life that had close links to fascism. Whoever is talking about Lewis there, actually.
No, all the modernists. A lot of them were attracted to fascism.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Pound. Pound as well.
So, what's your question?
Who is saying that quote, Marjorie?
Yeah. Now the thing is that the word modernism is an argumented, discussed, argued over word.
Yeah.
Because you have in the 800 years ago, you had the ancients who used the trivium and quadrivium. There was a new bunch of guys at the Sorbonne called scholastics, or the moderni, M-O-D-E-R-N-I,
uh-huh.
You know, Latin for moderns. And so the moderns versus the ancients goes on from, 1200 A.D. to now. That's what McLuhan's Ph.D. is about, the ancient quarrel. But in normal literary scholarship or analyzing meanings of words, they argue over, did modernism begin with the Renaissance, with the printing press and the burst of technologies, or did it begin with the French Revolution, or did it begin with electricity? There's a lot of different schools of thought about where modernism, the modern movement, began. When I talked to Nelson Rockefeller through the Evergreens with McLuhan and other people in that second panel I did, he said... Nelson Rockefeller believed that it started with the Renaissance. And he was talking about how they tried to stop technological development and control it, the Rockefellers, and it was a genie out of the bottle. And then he goes as an afterthought, and basically it was out of the bottle since the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of political fights over science and technologies used as weapons for 600 years. Now we're in a wholly new situation, which people call postmodern, or now even post-human.
Uh-huh.
So then there is the writers around Pound, Joyce, Lewis, Eliot, Yeats. Yeats is like just barely getting in there. He was an older guy. And then other movements in America and the rest of Europe, they were all called the modernists, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them, like Lewis and Pound and Eliot, sided with the right wing in the period after World War I.
Well, did they side with the right wing to stop modernism?
Were they- No. They were modernists, mm-hmm. and they were revolutionary in their techniques of writing poetry and prose, new effects.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they had very conservative, reactionary political views. That's why they were considered elitist. They wrote difficult works like the Cantos and Ezra Pound. Ezra Pound did the Cantos, and Joyce is doing Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake. And they were not easily understood by the masses. And so it was like, well, they're elitist, they're fascist, they don't want to hang out with the working class. So they got more and more rejected as the 20th century unfolded.
Okay.
Unless you were a fascist or right winger yourself or an elitist, then you would study those guys a lot to reinforce your elitism.
Mm-hmm.
But McLuhan came along to say, no, they weren't elitists, and they were actually very involved with the people because they saw the new hidden ground of electric media as creating a new software mm-hmm. communism, a new populism, a new multi-democracies. That's where McLuhan was able to write about these fascists without worrying about their politics. He had a different way to talk about them.
Right. So the end of this paragraph that we've been reading, this last sentence says, for sure, in the 1960s, McLuhan was ahead of his time when writing about Joyce, Pound, Lewis, and other modernist masters, not following the domesticated line of interpretation. He pioneered new interdisciplinary approaches.
Yeah, it was really interesting to walk around the 60s and 70s knowing that, knowing McLuhan, reading McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whenever I was near a university, I'd drop in. There might be a professor that I knew of because I never was a student. But they wouldn't talk about McLuhan. They had no clue about McLuhan. So actually there was no one to talk to about what I was interested in, no one to talk to about Zappa. Especially among the intellectuals. And so I knew that McLuhan was, ahead of his time back
mm-hmm.
then.
Mm-hmm.
And this sentence is, 100% true.
Mm-hmm.
He figured out a way and created a whole new way. And, I would say that he got the modernist message. He understood what they were about.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was talking to Cynthia the other day, who was a student of professor at St. Avex, who was a McLuhanite, but she didn't take a course from him. She took a course from another guy who was a poet, and he taught Ezra Pound, and she says, I still don't know what the hell Pound's about. And I never understood Pound, and my teacher didn't help me understand. So then I said a few things to her, just using McLuhan, who she had later met, and she was amazed at just how that opened her eyes, just a few sentences from McLuhan. And the McLuhanites at St. Avex, George Sanderson and Father McSween, I think his name is, they were into McLuhan. They didn't apply it to their teaching for some reason.
Mm. Yeah, even the notion that Pound and these guys were motivated by the electric age.
Yeah, these professors were too literary bookbound. And so I would bring up the non-Gutenberg parts, and they weren't interested in that. They didn't believe it, basically. The only guy who was open to it was Harry Whittier, the great English prof at Dalhousie.
Mm-hmm.
And we would talk about McLuhan via Thomas Pynchon.
Mm-hmm.
He was really into Pynchon.
Okay, so this, we're going down several paragraphs. It's the end of the paragraph that starts with, I think it is more appropriate to define modernist poetics as elitist in their rendering, but not in their underpinning strategies. See that one?
Yep.
So you read the book, so you're kind of remembering. This is just saying what you just said.
Yep.
And the last sentence is, inevitably, if we continue to read modernist art and narrative only through ideology, then we might decide that those provocative experiments and achievements were not only elitist but also conservative. However, this is an approach which, though it has some points, risks blinding us to other more articulated perspectives.
Yeah, what happened in the 30s? The world became, you know, totally divided, like you could say America is today, or the world is today, leading up to World War II, between the fascists and the communists. And Lewis and all the writers took sides. And a lot of people went for the left, and a lot of people went for the right. So McLuhan says the messages of the 20s from Pound and Lewis and Joyce and Eliot were lost in the ideological arguments of the 30s, the politicization of everything. So that the poets of the 30s, Stephen Spender, I think it is, and W.H. Auden, people like that, British poets, they did not learn the poetic wisdom and insights of the vortices of Joyce and the modernists of the teens and 20s. So that poetry took a step backward, according to McLuhan. And then World War II happened, then the atomic bomb happened, that ended history, and it obsolesced the role of the artist, as McLuhan says in his essay, The Southern Quality, which is in the interior landscape. So it had to be a renovation of what's the role of poetry, prose, writing, art, sculpture, music. And McLuhan saw that the modernists had an answer that was lost in the 30s. So he retrieved the modernists, the breakthrough media levels of Pound and McLuhan. And I was reading a Pound scholar who pointed out that the two major Pound scholars were Hugh Kenner and some other guy. And Hugh Kenner has a big influence on Pound studies. He was a student of McLuhan. And so this professor points out that McLuhan was the founder of Pound Studies, because the two or three professors that laid the foundation for it were heavily influenced by McLuhan. And so regular Pound scholarship does not know this. It's interesting how, you know, the greats get lost.
Right.
You know, Zappa is maybe not understood or acknowledged as much as he should be. McLuhan isn't. But something, the world is starting to look at McLuhan over since the 90s
right.
now.
Well, look at what she says. We can jump to the next section, Universal Quest, Fragmented Rendering, and going down into her second paragraph, she's saying, I consider The Mechanical Bride as McLuhan's most modernist work. So she's going back to, when was that published, 54?
51.
51, yeah. I consider The Mechanical Bride as McLuhan's most modernist work, while his later books establish his most original mosaic. The Bride brings together formal experimentation, cross-hybridization of high and popular art forms, and the denunciation of all those hidden agencies which were redesigning culture, power, and therefore society by taking advantage of a numbered and accommodating
audience.
An accommodating audience. So anyway, I thought that was neat that she went back and acknowledged the Mechanical Bride as a modernist beginning.
Yeah, I'm annotating The Mechanical Bride right now, and I agree with her 100%. It is a really important work, and a lot of his book self, the literary origins coming from modern studies, is in The Mechanical Bride. But he quickly realized it didn't sell, it just was a thud, and he started to realize, with the help of Harold Innes and more in-depth studies of Finnegans Wake with Don Thiel, and also having met Ezra Pound in 48, because he was writing Mechanical Bride and showing slideshows from like 44, 45, 46, you know. It took a long time for the book to come out. When it came out in 51, he wasn't even interested in the book. It was obsolete from his point of view. So the non-book or the post-book McLuhan shows up in 53 with the Explorations magazine and the Ford Foundation seminar. And that's where he becomes really original. The literary roots are not so obvious in his later work, because it's obvious in Mechanical Bride. But he said television changed everything. And the rules and insights he got from movies and radio and automobiles for the mechanical era, or early electric mechanical era, electromechanical, maybe Don Thiel would call it, that could be described the way the Mechanical Bride presents it. But now you're beyond the mechanical into an information android meme beginning to grow, a whole new dimension, and McLuhan had to develop a new strategy. So it's his genius that he was able to adapt and drop the Mechanical Bride. But you do have to understand Mechanical Bride for her point, and she's right. It's the most modernist book. It's like the key book for what she's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of amazing statements in the Mechanical Bride, which you can apply. You can see how he applies it later.
Mm-hmm.
But applies it to a new media landscape. So what did you ask there, or what's the theme here?
Yeah, that was it. We start with Mechanical Bride, and then the
and establish his most original mosaic.
Yeah.
You know, he goes into territory that it, maybe Pound didn't understand it. Elliot didn't even know about it. Joyce was dead, but Pound thought, as McLuhan would write to him in the early 50s, what he was doing with the new media analysis he wrote about making this book, The Gutenberg Galaxy, Pound spit on it and said it was nonsense. So McLuhan was original. He came up with the implications of their writings that they didn't even fully realize, it seems.
Mm.
And he applied it non-politically, non-ideologically.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, Lewis, he might have got what McLuhan was saying, but he's dead in a couple of years because McLuhan was using Lewis. Lewis was technically the most media-oriented guy on the surface and writing about it in his prose.
Right. Well, the next part, I lost my my script for a moment there. The next part, she goes into comparing his work with an American Dos Pasos.
Yeah, John Dos Pasos. I've never heard it said. I don't know how you say it, but let's just say Dos Pasos. McLuhan writes an essay in the Interior Landscape, written, I guess, in the 50s, where he shows Dos Pasos takes the insights from Joyce's Ulysses and applies it to the United States. He tries to make a new kind of novel, but he's a Barbara Ehrenreich. He's a political activist. He wants this to help the working man.
Mm-hmm.
So McLuhan's essay is about how Dos Pasos doesn't get the message of Ulysses the way at least McLuhan thought it should be understood.
Mm-hmm.
So Dos Pasos is an important writer for a short while, but he fails to get the longer message, and therefore fades off the scene.
Yeah, she says that McLuhan sees his words, Dos Pasos, as undermined by the writer's explicit ideological agenda, something which situates those works inside a specific time and place. So, yeah, it's a novelization of what McLuhan was trying to make as a mosaic.
Yeah, you know, yeah, Dos Pasos was in the 20s and 30s, and the collapse of the economy and the depression and the issues in the 30s were what were of major concern to, you know, reasonably thinking people. And Dos Pasos saw his novels as helping get the working class into a better situation, which led to, you know, unemployment insurance and the New Deal by Roosevelt.
Mm.
So McLuhan has an interesting statement. I don't have it right here. He says, Dos Pasos was successful in that agenda of helping a better situation for the working class come out of the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of long-range media effects, he's useless.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's where you go back to Ulysses and Finney's Wake to get the what was really going to wreck the working class in, by the 70s, the new android meme economy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so the reforms of the radio era were necessary, but in the long run, they are failing to help the working class,
mm-hmm.
the New Deal reforms. The
yeah.
neoconservative is attacking the Roosevelt program.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, so then we don't have to go into that.
And that's a media effect, McLuhan would say.
Mm-hmm.
That the rise of neoconservatism is a product of the digital economy.
Right. Okay, so then page 100, she's going into Heisenberg.
Right, that's physics.
So that, to emphasize her point about subjectivity and time and space. But I don't know if you want to stop there or just keep moving.
Why stop there? What do you mean stop?
Do you want to discuss Heisenberg and Poe's the idea of subjectivity over something which is supposed to be totally objective, that is scientific observation? I don't know why she throws all that in there.
Well, it's dealing with McLuhan's, say, the user is the content.
Mm.
See, if McLuhan is a scientist and he's bringing in subjectivity through the user is the content, then she might want to find some scientists who were going in that direction to prop up McLuhan's kind of science.
Okay.
So it is important. So pick a sentence or two out of here. You got here Heisenberg composes that one you just read. Do you want to say a little bit more about continue reading that paragraph.
Yeah, I clipped that whole thing. Heisenberg imposes the idea of subjectivity over something which is supposed to be totally objective, that is scientific observation. The modernist writers and poets often portray themselves as new scientific observers, in turn vivisecting their own society through their impersonal poetics.
Yeah, they were adopting, 100 years ago, the scientific mass, the scientific pose to catch up because science is what the world was interested in that period, before World War I and subsequent. So they put on the scientific mask, culminating in McLuhan saying he started a new science.
Mm-hmm.
He's completing Eliot, Joyce, Pound, and Lewis.
Right.
And that's what she said. So, but how do you do that? How do you claim, prose and poetry is science?
Mm-hmm.
You've got to bring in the subjective element and say that's important in science. And by the way, LaRouche says that, too. That's what's interesting about LaRouche.
Mm-hmm.
He objects to British positivist empiricist science because it knocked out the subjective element.
Right. Well, vivisecting, does that mean if you harshly critique something, it's scientific?
No. Vivisection is a, carving up the entrails of something.
Right.
Remember that?
Of course.
And,
I do it all the time.
Right. And Joyce regarded himself through the character Stephen Dedalus as a vivisectionist.
Uh-huh.
And he vivisectioned or created a cross-section view of society. That's what their canvas was in their books.
Mm-hmm.
So being a vivisectionist is very important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And continuing, they question the absolute romantic ideal vision of humanity and the centrality of the author. They do not trust the poet as the sole medium, and they look for models to provide a parallel capable of conveying a shared universality. Brackets, Joyce and Myth, Pound and Epic.
Yeah, so here are these poets who are called fascist politically and right-wing elitists making poetry like McLuhan's aphoristic technique from Francis Bacon that encouraged people to participate in the making of it.
Mm-hmm.
Joyce's meaning is not the only meaning important in the work.
Mm-hmm.
It starts to include the making process of being a reader or a listener. So that's bringing in the reader's subjectivity and acknowledging it. And that's pretty revolutionary in the world of science.
Mm-hmm.
So revolutionary that science ignores it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So good. The next I have is...
See, they want to share universality. They want to create a way that people are forced to engage and figure out what the meaning is by not making it so flat and obvious.
Yeah.
In McLuhan terms, hot is high-definition one-way song, whereas cool is you have to figure out what Joyce and Lewis are getting at.
And then she gets into metaphors. And toward the middle of that paragraph, most metaphors translating modernist poetics acknowledge at once the attempt to foster objectivity in observation and the paradox of the subject being part of all such processes. Life, therefore, is perceived as an impression or as a luminous halo or as a semi-transparent envelope through which we are challenged to look. So what's all that about?
So most metaphors translating modernist poetics acknowledge at once the attempt to foster objectivity and observation and the paradox of the subject being part of all such processes. So the very thing I was talking about, include the reader in the understanding of the metaphor, is their goal. So then they say, and the paradox of the subject being part of all such processes, that's a colon. Life, therefore, is perceived as an impression or as a luminous halo or as a semi-transparent envelope through which we are challenged to look. I don't know if that includes enough of the Thomas view, St. Thomas Aquinas, where the observer is the observed and is part of the perceptual process. Mm. This has got more of the visual bias of a luminous halo, an envelope, you perceive, you kind of look through. Mm-hmm. You're challenged to look. The other senses are brought in these modernist works. Mm-hmm. Like, largely, Finney's Wake is a tactile book.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, you feel your way through. You can't see it.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. You picked up that they were visual metaphors. I do that in medicine. I'm very observant of medical stuff, but you're very observant of these literary phrasings.
Right. Then she writes, even more, objectivity itself is based precisely on the acknowledgement of the ways the subject might interfere, change, or condition the act of observation. Mm. You know, that's like the populism meaning of the, was it the law of uncertainty? Mm. Heisenberg's principle,
yes,
of uncertainty, is it? Yep. Where the user alters the observation of the particle.
Mm-hmm.
What complicates, what complicates the analysis even further is the fact that most modernist poetics were not always born from a writer's neutral approach to society, but were in fact inscribed inside a more entangled participation in the historical and political events of the time. For instance, Ezra Pound's Guide to Culture, written at the time of Pound's flirtation with the Italian fascist regime, is ambiguously presented as a series of notes for a totalitarian treatise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Subjectivity and objectivity are also components of McLuhan's media investigations, especially as far as their rendering is concerned. So McLuhan is modernist in that sense. He includes the ambiguity of the interplay of the two of them, objectivity and subjectivity. So you get the next quote.
Okay. As the discussion of McLuhan as a media guru has shown, he borrowed the idea of a marriage between poetry, the arts, and sciences as a basic tenet for his own media explorations and understanding. He always maintained that he had no point of view on the situations he was investigating and always underlined his detachment as an explorer, bracket, the modernists would have spoken of aloofness, bracket. He often repeated that his was a mobile point of view because that is what the act of probing literally implies. Now, she's said that many times before, so,
yeah.
You know, that's just, repetition. So, and then, you know, she says if you have a point of view, it means that you have already mastered the situation. You are not with the situation. You have already abstracted it and angled it.
She says, did you see this? Finding himself inside the new media maelstrom, McLuhan was still assessing the action of the vortex, which he was seeking to understand.
Mm.
And she quotes him, if you have a point of view, it means that you have already mastered. Oh, yeah, that's what you just read. I didn't know where you were. That's McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
Is it McLuhan? Let's see, 11.
11. If I look it up, I lose my page.
Yeah, 11, chapter 5. Yeah, it's McLuhan in 1958.
Okay.
If you have a point of view, it means that you have already mastered the situation. You are not with the situation. You have already abstracted it and angled it.
Right. Okay, well, let's jump ahead because she's just giving some examples of of that with other authors, but let's go to Make You Feel, Probing Through Language. In the 1930s, while at Cambridge, McLuhan learned more about the shift from Victorian to modernist mentality. In particular, he began to appreciate the complexity of the modernist research, which he perceived, in fact, as a struggle to develop a form capable of preserving the integrity of the process of observation. So, complexity of modernist research, was that a term back then, modernist research, or
no?
Is she just saying that because he was a literary critic?
Yeah, she's talking about from 2020 hindsight. What she's already, we were just quoting, they are mixing objectivity and subjectivity. It's complex observation.
Right. And
see, she says, being themselves inside the whirlpool, yes, literary and artistic, yes, experiments were questioning the world.
Mm-hmm.
Modernist writers took to translating movement and uncertainties through their hallucinatory and fragmented renderings of their sporadic epiphanies. It was thus inevitable that modernist narratives or poetry did not comfort the reader, did not confirm traditional values, did not encourage accepted ideas, and did not progress in linear and reassuring ways.
Right.
On the contrary, they deconstructed all commonplaces to show, quote, the community in action. That's the Vivi section, showing the community in action, unquote. Then she says, they unveiled and rendered the chaos, the disorder, the aporias, which inevitably accompany change and shock readers. Through their work, they provoked, attacked, and by so doing, stimulated critical thinking. So that's quite different from a scientist's speculative format.
But he's implying that the readership was getting all stirred up. What, I mean, is there anybody reporting what the readers thought of these authors?
Well, there were lots of reviews. And Eliot fared the best in the sense he was sort of not so complicated. But Pound and Lewis and Joyce were... as they did their later work, were kind of ignored.
Of course, yeah, I know that.
Because you read those later chapters.
Right, yeah, okay. So then I'm going to just...
They shocked their readers too much.
Right.
And now, I said scientists didn't do that. Well, maybe Richard Feynman, these more controversial scientists, is just they were shocking their audience. But... it was limited to visual science and visual mathematics and precision in the lab, coming up with new discoveries caused by newer microscopes or newer technologies. But these guys were running around in public and in their arts and being chaotic for most people.
Right. So on page 103, see if you can find the word Marchand toward the end of the page. And... Marchand recalls Eliot's auditory imagination.
Yeah.
Write for the ears.
How do you write for the ears?
I know. So it's finally bringing in something other than just the eyes. It's bringing in the auditory, but let's see where they go with this. Write for the ears. The words you will see are not the words you will hear. And read me with your ears are the primary instructions that modernist writers offer to their readers, suggesting a different approach not only to their works but also to their times. Now, Marchand is saying that, in the 2000s?
He's saying that in 1989.
Ooh. Sorry, Marchand. So did anyone notice that back then?
Well, Marchand is quoting the modernists. If anybody was a student of McLuhan, you know, reasonable, attentive, you would know that Yeats said it first. All his work was to shift towards the ear, and he was saying that about his stuff in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And then Joyce is the one who said, the words you will see are not the words you will hear. And Eliot had the doctrine of the auditory imagination. And I don't know who said write for the ears. Unless she doesn't have any footnote. Read me with your ears. They're all generally the same idea, suggesting a different approach not only to their works but also to their times. Experiencing modernist art means, therefore, experiencing change and being on the alert, sort of attentive to the world about you rather than just in your study, in your literary office. A really good book about this and has a different view is Professor Vincent Sherry's book called Ezra Pound, Wyndham Lewis, and Radical Modernism. And the battle between the eye and the ear, which McLuhan plays up and which Joyce did in Phineas Wake, came out of the 19th century. That's a scholarly point that I've never seen any McLuhanite acknowledge or even know about. But Vincent Sherry, who was, I don't know if he was a Canadian, but he was a student of McLuhan in the 70s, early 70s, and he teaches in the States now. But his book that I just cited is really important.
So I like the next sentence.
There is a predecessor for the battle between the eye and the ear in the 19th century, and McLuhan never pointed that out. The way his student, Vincent Sherry, does.
So I like the next sentence. McLuhan adopted the modernist idea of art as warning signal. So we know about that, the due line.
Yeah.
But I don't have anything clipped until page 104.
Right.
And she's talking about the professor of English and the media scholar again, so that's repetition. She mentioned Victorian narratives were obsolete and had to be replaced by experimental forms, more elusive and in progress, so that's repetition.
More elusive, A-L-L?
Elusive.
Oh.
And then the last paragraph. Words were no longer perceived as abstractions, but as containers of multiple meanings, constantly reassembled and hybridized with other semiological codes, from music to painting, from theater to cinema. You find words and sounds on Picasso's canvases, music on Joyce's pages, cinematic close-ups in Fitzgerald's descriptions. Modernist productions are no longer monosensorial, but multisensorial. That is, multimedia renderings. Again, like a summing up, repetition.
Yeah, let me just read. Did you start at But the Modernist also? No, Victorian narratives. Mm-hmm. I didn't follow when you were doing it. Victorian narratives were obsolete and had to be replaced by experimental forms, more elusive and in progress. You know, like Joyce's Phineas Wake called Work in Progress. But the modernists also taught McLuhan that such elusiveness was counterbalanced by the solidity of language rediscovered through the study of etymology. Words were no longer perceived as abstraction, but as containers of multiple meanings, constantly reassembled and hybridized with other semiological codes, from music to painting, from theater to cinema. You find words and sounds on Picasso's canvases, music on Joyce's pages, cinematic close-ups in Fitzgerald's descriptions. Mm-hmm. That's that. And then : modernist productions are no longer monosensorial, but multisensorial. That is, multimedia renderings. Okay, so they talk about McLuhan learning new criticism from Leavis and Richards in Cambridge in the 30s. And those guys developed the multi-semantic meaning of words. But McLuhan said he went further, or he developed another direction. He pointed out not the multi-semantic meanings of words, but the multi-spaces that media created.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a vaster, bigger scale than the new criticism. That's why he dropped new criticism. Mm. So she's talking here, the elusiveness was counterbalanced by the solidity of language rediscovered through the study of etymology. That's not what McLuhan was doing. That's what new criticism was doing. Then she says words were no longer perceived as abstraction, but as containers of multiple meanings. That's Leavis and Richards' multi-semantic meanings. Constantly reassembled and hybridized. Now this is where she gets into McLuhan's level, with other semiological codes or other media codes, from music to painting, from theater to cinema. She should mention radio and TV. You find words and sounds on Picasso's canvases. So She's bringing in the Gutenberg arts are mixing with the semantic meanings.
Mm-hmm.
But the blatant multimedia scale isn't said to the very end. She says modernist productions are no longer monosensorial, that's visual, but multisensorial, but what's more important, and she says it, multimedia. That's what McLuhan did. He moved it out of the locked-in mono media of print.
Right.
Not just mixing it with other Gutenberg arts like music, painting, sculpture, and theater and opera, but multi-spaces. And because he was one of the first to see that, if not the only person, nobody understood what he was talking about in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody believed it.
Yeah, so she kind of sums it up toward the end of page 105. McLuhan literally put the modernists on, so much so that I think his books on media are based on those experiments.
Where's that? I can't find that.
I know. It's in right in the middle of a paragraph.
Well, what's the paragraph start with?
The paragraph begins with, yes, it would have made a huge difference.
Okay, so in the middle he says, as I mentioned earlier, right?
Yeah.
McLuhan literally put the modernists on, so much so that I think his books on media are based on those experiments. What experiments? The modernist experiments, I guess?
Mm. On his experiments of using them.
Right. Their experiments, putting them on. Now, another guy, Glenn Wilmot, put out a book called, you know, McLuhan was a modernist in reversal. Or in reverse.
Hmm.
So that's a pretty good title. And she's aware of that book. And it's not just putting them on. He actually turns them upside down. He takes their ideas and then presents them completely differently from what they were thought they were doing. So I'm just saying it depends on what. I guess reversing them could be considered a put on.
Mm-hmm.
They're based on those experiments, but he did experiments with actual new technologies in laboratory conditions in the 1560s. Those are the experiments he based his work on, not the weird multi-semantic meaning of the cantos and Finnegan's Wake, or the multi-collage effects that Pound and Joyce did. Non-literary media experiments.
Mm-hmm.
So you start to get the early McLuhan, which he's describing, and then the later McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
The later McLuhan is outside of the box of Gutenberg culture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can't. I mean, partly what's a little bit confining about this book is that she is trying to put him in a literary box, but.
Yeah, you could write another book, which Don Thiel often did, probing the Marconi origins of media studies.
Mm-hmm.
That would mean the filmmaker Eisenstein, the artist Moholy Nagy, a lot of the non-literary arts. She has cinema here, but the...
she doesn't have YouTube.
The... radical changes in painting and in installation art, conceptual art, all these new... What did you just say? She didn't have... Yeah, YouTube. You see, it's the other arts. There are seven arts traditionally that go way back. She's emphasizing the literary ones, not the media ones. So Don Thiel would say Don Thiel would criticize Jim Carrey, Walter Ong, because they emphasize too much the interplay between orality and literacy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Thiel said that Joyce was emphasizing the kinetic, mechanical environments, the automobile, the train, and the tactile media like radio and television. So you have the kinetic versus the tactile, is what Thiel mentions, rather than the literary, oral versus literary.
Mm-hmm.
Oral versus literature, see? So to be a comprehensive, replay of McLuhan's Mosaic, you would not limit yourself to the literary origins. So she knows that. She knows that there is this multimedia influence, but she's emphasizing the literary part so far.
Sure. Okay, so what I like next is...
He could put on the modernist literary origins or literary experiments because he was in another swimming pool. Mm-hmm. He was swimming in a post-Gutenberg world after World War One, yeah. World War Two.
It detached him, put him outside of that.
Even more so.
Yeah. What I like next is an Italian edition of the interior landscape is introduced by a media critic or literary critic who gives this quote that Lamberti says captures the essence of McLuhan's modernist lesson. So it's kind of a wrap-up, and it is actually the end of this chapter. McLuhan tells us that literary criticism should not be academic, but should learn from Pound. It should be clearly polemic, brave enough to tell what must be told. That's why McLuhan also tells us academics have ignored Pound's criticism, or when they acknowledged it, they were against it. Pound's criticism, capable to illuminate two masters like Yeats and Eliot, constitutes, in fact, the ground of his Cantos, which is the greatest poem of our century, still the most misrepresented one. McLuhan applies the lesson he learned from the great masters of literature to the study of mass media, not to the messages they convey, but to their language, to their process, in order to codify their functioning and to avoid becoming their slave. So that sort of brings it a little more up to date.
In what way?
Just the way of in using Pound's actual modus operandi. He's saying McLuhan uses Pound's way of writing to flog his audience.
And the mass media.
And brings it into the present day.
So this is a person saying the same thing as Lamberti.
Mm-hmm.
That the lessons of the avant-garde radical modernist experiments can be applied to understanding McLuhan's evaluation of to the newer landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these literary origins, as you're learning as you get through the book, it's a really important point and has to be understood, but it is not the whole story on McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
See, through modernism, McLuhan developed an approach to media aimed at understanding the hidden ground of patterns underpinning each medium. When he was like 19 years old, he was writing in his diary that one must understand advertising and the laws that come out of that. So he was looking at non-book media to think about even in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So his origins are not just Cambridge. He was getting these ideas from University of Manitoba, from particular professors, and Cameron McEwen is the authority on that. He writes probably the best, most scholarly, accurate review of McLuhan's works and origins.
Mm-hmm.
And he emphasizes these professors that McLuhan had in Winnipeg at the University of Manitoba. And those professors were influenced by some very interesting professors at the University of Chicago, like Robert Park, who influenced Harold Innes, who's going to end up in much the same place as McLuhan by 1950. So, and there are many books who describe that part. And I guess I'm pretty sure Elena has read those books and is aware of that. But she just thought this was a big missing point. But you risk ending up focusing too much on the literary origins of McLuhan. He had to drop all that, in a way. And then he reinterpreted the cantos and fitting his way through the lens of technology, which nobody else agreed with. And McLuhan was projecting his own post-book interest back onto the modernists. In that sense, he was putting them on and exploiting them in reverse.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to tell people how McLuhan got where he got, where his ideas came from. He interpreted everything through the lens of technology, just like you interpret the world through McLuhan.
Through ion. That was through ion. Yeah. But it's interesting. Nobody understood McLuhan's interpretation of Pound and Joyce, so that they're not any big deal until maybe recently. For most of his lifetime, he was ignored in those fields.
Mm-hmm.
And he was ignored in the fields that she's saying he got his main insights from. But no, his insights were original, were actually bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
And the bigger influence on that level would be Wyndham Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And because McLuhan says in the 50s, Wyndham Lewis was the first guy to take on the new media en bloc, E-N-B-L-O-C, like
mm-hmm.
in toto. So it's a tricky line writing about McLuhan. It's almost any book, no matter what angle they take, is not going to get McLuhan. The only way you get McLuhan is to read and understand what Joyce is doing in Finning His Wake, because
mm-hmm.
McLuhan is imitating that, you know, to the max.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The pointless, the pixels of the cathode ray tube black and white television of the 50s, look at the screen back then. That is a page of Finney's Wake. You're looking at the screen of an early television.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not in linear lines, not even in photographic lines like the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's pointless. It's very tiny. Each word is a whole world. Each syllable is a whole world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is ridiculous for 99.9% of humanity
mm-hmm.
to try to read a book like that. What's the point? Well, it has no point unless you notice that it's anticipating the dynamics of later media environments, including the email texting world we're in today. Joyce's Finney's Wake is miming the texting world. Now, that is incredible. Now, he didn't know that it was going to go that way unless he traveled through the future and saw stuff. But let's assume he didn't. When I talked to him through the Evergreens, he was ambivalent about McLuhan. He said McLuhan was great because he took Joyce on Joyce's terms. He didn't put some ideology. He didn't project an idea about Joyce from McLuhan's own Catholic bias or Thomistic bias. He just looked at what is this book and what is it like or what is it reflecting.
Mm-hmm.
So Joyce admired that. He said McLuhan was the only guy who looked at his work clearly without prejudice. But he would then, talking to Joyce, he would agree that the Thunders had technological elements. But later, when I was bringing up McLuhan talking to Joyce, he said, wait a minute, don't project Joyce, don't project McLuhan on me, you know, too much.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
probably the way McLuhan interprets, or Eric McLuhan, his son, interprets the Ten Thunders is not exactly the way Joyce meant it. But it is the best use of the Thunders. There's no other reason to look at a 10 garbled, 100-lettered words that are just fun to pronunciate for a few minutes. Why write? How could you be a masterpiece if you're just getting people to say words differently? You know, there has to be a larger opinion or a purpose to it, and that's what McLuhan, he figured out how to fit these crazy people that he wanted to teach, and one of the earlier teachers mm-hmm. of modernists. He had to figure out how they made sense for the history of literature and the history of post-literature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he was original. He figured out how to take their mistaken lives and puny mm-hmm. right-wing nutball experiences and made them part of a larger logos or rationality. That's really an amazing act by a critic.
Yeah, he was a vivisectionist. To
of them.
Of them, and figured out what was making them
tick.
Tick and jump around like little puppets.
And then not just present it as a theory, present it as a toolkit for us to apply to society.
Mm-hmm.
He made the history of literature get somewheres. That's what's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
In a post-literate world, which McLuhan predicted, will not read. reading and writing will be like fox hunting, some obscure art that some aristocrats or some private people will be doing.
Cool. Okay, Bob.
Now, I'll add a point. Don Thiel reminds us, though, that McLuhan, yes, he said the book was obsolete and it would have to adapt. Thiel takes it further and says the book doesn't die. It just gets used in new, different formats and different purposes, which McLuhan said, but most people don't say that. Thiel emphasized that, that the book mutates and becomes whatever you think books are odd today and were really odd compared to how people looked at books in the 30s and 40s. So the metamorphoses were logical when McLuhan put his senses on them. You know, there's a famous Canadian poet. I think his name was A.J. Pratt. He wrote a poem about McLuhan, and he said, McLuhan took a telescope and put the telescope to his ear and said, ah, what a lovely smell we have here. So he was hallucinating on acid, synesthesia, the mixture of the senses. That is a pretty good poem on what McLuhan did. He put a telescope, which you use for your eye, up against his ear, something like Garrett would do, Garrett Dean, and then said, what a lovely smell we have here.
Yeah.
So now make... So McLuhan put a movie up to his ear.
No. A movie.
Oh, that's a good way. He ate a movie.
And out the other end
came a book.
Yeah.
Let me see what came a fantasia. No, yeah. He ate a movie, and World War III came out of it. Okay?
Out of his ass.
Yeah, out of his ass, World War III. That the medium caused the war by causing a civil war among all the other media or your senses.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I don't think most people see eating a movie would cause World War III or IV.
Mm-hmm.
But that sounds absurd enough to make the point, I think, that Mr. Pratt was trying to make.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Are you finished?
Hour. Yeah, we did the whole chapter.
Okay. Well, that's it. Now we see what people want to ask if they are such people.